This is Jerry Toome with Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
We have one of my favorites for an interview. His name's David Abramson. They are, by the way, in Canada. They're up in Montreal, I believe. But the bottom line, Dave's been around forever. He was a commodity trader in the pits in Chicago. He did primarily oil and things like that. He's got great expertise in this. And again, he's one of my favorite interviews we've ever done. And this one, he almost outdid himself. I'm thinking, you know, this is a phenomenal interview with Dave. And he's good at breaking it down and talking to normal people. He's not somebody that's going to talk, you know, hyper technology thinking kind of thing that most people can't understand. He's great at doing that. We're going to talk about the tariff war. We're going to talk about China and America being at an impasse. What is that going to look like? The outlook for gold and oil and essentially Trump's administration, what's going on there. He had some phenomenal comments. This, again, is one of my favorite people to interview on the show on Smart Money. His name's Dave Abramson, and it's Alpine Macro, and their website is alpinemacro.com. Again, so they're institutionally priced, so these are special interviews, folks. Y'all get to hear from people that are, again, most of you would not spend the kind of money that we spend on the research. Some of you out there, maybe you're an institutional investor, maybe you're a family office or whatever, then this would be one that I would strongly recommend that you look at because they're outstanding in their long-term approach on how they do it. Let's talk to Dave Abramson with Alpine Macro. Well, welcome to the wild, wild world of tariffs. We have David Abramson of Alpine Macro with us on the show today. Dave, welcome back. I'm really appreciative of you coming on. I know I want to talk about the tariff wild world right now. Your views, Alpine's views, are number one, this will be inflationary in the short run, so no matter how much we do tariffs, it's going to boost the prices, and the profit margins can't hold up unless they boost their prices. But in the long run, deflationary. Would you please explain this to our listeners? Why would it be inflationary on the front end and deflationary on the back end of these tariff wars?
Thanks so much for having me, Jerry. I think it's easier for us to understand that because we've been through the 2021-22 supply-driven shock coming out of the pandemic where prices went up a lot in a short period of time, faster than we'd seen probably since 1981. And then the rate of growth of inflation just slowed right down after that to 2 or 3%. In our minds, that's how we're thinking about this. There's two ways you can interpret an increase in tariffs, and that helps you to answer your question. The first is it's a tax on consumers. So in Trump 1.0, the academic studies now show that 80 to 100% of the tariff increase was paid for by U.S. consumers. If that happens again, that will be like a really big tax on consumers. So we're not saying that in the long run, those prices, the level of prices will reverse. What we're saying is that it's a one-time increase in prices if that was the whole story. Now, the controversy is it might not be the whole story because what tariffs also do is it messes up the supply side, the ability of the U.S. consumers to get those goods. They were getting them from imports. Maybe the tariff increases will be so prohibitive that a number of suppliers from abroad will just go out of business. And you won't just get a price increase. You may not get the goods at all. And so that the supply side is affected. It may be that supply chains are broken, that while it takes a long time to onshore those jobs, which is what the Trump administration wants to do, that while it's taking all that time, the supply side is impacted. And so it's very simple conceptually. If the hit to demand is more than the reduction in the supply side, you get deflation. if the hit to demand, you can still have weaker demand, but if the hit of the ability to supply those goods is hit even harder, you're going to get upward pressure on prices. So we're in the camp that it's going to feel like inflation short term, but as time goes by, it's going to be more like, well, there's less money in the pockets of consumers to spend on other things, and it'll just be a difficult pricing environment, totally unlike the 1970s, which we've talked about previously on this show.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. As a matter of fact, I appreciate you explaining that because it's the best explanation I've heard so far. And, of course, we do a lot of interviews. All right, so I want to jump a little bit. I'm going to jump around here, if you don't mind, from one topic to another. But China is on my mind in terms of this. And I know China and America seem to be at really an impasse. Looks to me like a trade war, probably maybe even, you know, dividing the countries where they never want to talk to each other in terms of trade or industry. But if push comes to shove, this is what we'd hope doesn't ever happen. But I'm concerned about it. I'm very concerned about it. It could turn into a military war in the not-too-distant future. If China attempts to take Taiwan over, which Xi Jinping reportedly told his military to be ready to invade Taiwan by 2027, according to the CIA, this is a massive deal. What are the long-term investment ramifications that you would see from this, and societal, if you don't mind?
Sure thing, Jerry. Now, I'm going to answer the question a little more broadly than the one that you asked, but okay. I think it goes all the way back to Deng Xiaoping, which was in the 1970s.
Good.
He's the one that began the about turn from Mao, who just had these disastrous economic policies that really affected hundreds of millions of people extremely negatively. And Deng Xiaoping said, we're going to continue with what we call communism, but it's going to look a lot like capitalism to the outside observer. And he had some beautiful ways of putting it, but what he also said was, don't rush to do anything about Taiwan because time is on our side. And I think that's where the 2027 comes from, the belief that the military in China will be ready or can be ready and will be prepared to be ready to take Taiwan. Now, there's two comments here. First of all, that doesn't say anything is going to happen. It's a free option for the Chinese. They're spending a ton of money on their military. They're doing all kinds of incursions into the property area of Taiwan. They're doing all these things, not saying, well, if we don't invade by January 2027, then we'll have lost. No, of course not. It's a free option, and if they see the opportunity, they want to be ready for it. So that's one of the key things about Taiwan. The second thing is, and I think this is important more generally, Jerry, and again, I'm taking the question more broadly than you said, but I'm very concerned that there's a misperception going on right now about the reality of China, what China is doing, their approach to this trade war, and the U.S. perception, the perception in Washington by the government and elsewhere in Washington. There are a number of things that I think there's this misperception gap, and these things can lead to unexpected consequences. I'm not saying there's any military tensions coming this year, but there could be some big negative ramifications on the trade front. And I just, it's a lot deeper story than we have time for, but I do want to mention, I think in the heads of the Trump administration right now, they feel that China is much more vulnerable than they actually are. China's had a terrible real estate deflation the last 3 years. We've been extremely critical of the policy response, but they're coming out the other end. The first-tier cities, prices are already going up. The second tier are no longer deflating. And so that window of risk of extreme stress, we think it's closed. Is the Chinese economy going to boom? No, it isn't. But they have a lot of policy bullets that they can use to offset essentially these very, very high tariffs if they continue. This is an embargo. Whether it's 100% or 200% is irrelevant. There really won't be any trade between the U.S. and China at these levels of threatened tariffs. And then the last thing that I'll say is be careful about worrying that this will just escalate and escalate and escalate from trade war all the way to military war, et cetera. We've seen this in Canada where it was kind of the first tariff actions were on Canada, and it can de-escalate very quickly as it can escalate. It gets there's personalities involved. And so the premier of our largest province, Ontario, he kind of got hot under the collar and threatened electricity tariffs. And Trump came back and said, okay, you do that, I'm going to double. So it sounded like it was going to be this sort of awful outcome. And then they just kind of backed off. Mm-hmm. And now Canada actually has great potential to have some kind of settlement because of that. Now they have a back channel with Howard Lutnick. And so these things, she and Trump have already negotiated back in 2018. It could kind of cool off for a while as well. But again, that's not a direct answer to your question, but think about the free option rather than, oh, it's got to be in 2027.
I certainly hope you're right. And that makes sense to me. It never quite made sense on the timing. I'm concerned. I don't know if you've read the book, The Fourth Turning, but it looks like if we have anything like that, it may be next decade, at least I hope. So that's my comment.
I hope so, too.
All right. I want to switch to some asset allocation kind of decisions or questions here. I know you've been very bullish on gold and oil in the long run, and I know gold's performed marvelously well. Oil, obviously, is under threat because of the tariffs. Why don't you tell us what your long-term views on both gold and oil, if you don't mind, and take gold first and oil second, if that's okay.
Sure. Gold is pretty easy. We're bullish on it. So right now it's overbought and it's crowded. Essentially what's happened is, and I was a commodity strategist for 7 years,
right.
More or less the time when oil prices peaked at $147. I'm sure you remember that in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
And I did a commodity service for the following 7 years. And I did a lot of modeling of gold and oil prices, and it was very easy to model gold. You had a number of macro variables like real interest rates, the dollar, equity risk premium, great indicators of fair value. In the last 2 years, those relationships have all completely broken down, and it's only explained by foreign central bank demand for gold, which has been massive. Speculators have piled onto that. It's a very crowded trade right now, and so it can move around. It can correct hundreds of dollars an ounce and really not mean anything for the underlying trend. The key point long-term, the reason why we're bullish long-term is not that we're big inflationists, you can tell from my comments on tariffs, but that underlying demand from central banks for gold, it's highly unlikely to reverse, certainly over the next 3 or 4 years. And gold is one of these things where if there's underlying demand, it's quite a tight market. It's not like money markets or bond markets. You can't go and buy $1 trillion worth of gold. Central banks can hold $1 trillion worth of U.S. dollars. And so that alone would be enough to be bullish. But there's additional thing, those macro variables that I mentioned earlier that haven't worked the last few years, I think they're still working. It's just they've been swamped by foreign demand. But if real interest rates move lower and the dollar moves lower and the equity risk premium moves higher, these are three things I think are reasonable in the next few years, that will also supercharge gold. So that's gold. On oil, very different. So I'm not going to tell you what to think about shale or the Permian. I don't know a fraction of what people in Texas know. But what I can say, which is very clear, is that the supply-demand dynamics for the oil market have not been good. On the demand side, Chinese demand has been relatively weak. They loaded up with Russian oil after the sanctions were put in place. India loaded up with cheap Russian oil, and now they've got enough, and their economy is, it's just kind of, you know, it's ambling along. It's out of the worst, like I said before, but it's not booming. If you get any weakness in the U.S. economy against that demand backdrop, then oil prices, they're gonna test the downside, whatever that is, $40, $50. And on the supply side, OPEC seems to be willing to increase supply. Saudi share of the world oil market is at a record low. They can't be happy about that. And so all of that suggests that if oil prices are going to have a move in the next 3-6 months, they'll move lower. We kind of smelt that the last few weeks. But once you go beyond that, that's where things change. If China starts to improve, if the outlook for U.S. growth starts to improve, you can see that in the U.S., once you get to the low 50s, you're not going to get much drilling activity at those levels. And so I see it as a range between $50 and $90, and maybe we'll test the downside of that range if the U.S. economy tends to be weak. And longer term, we still need the oil. 5 years out, 8 years out, maybe 30 years out, we might not, but we still will need it. So longer term, if oil gets towards 50, that's a very attractive entry point as far as we're concerned.
That's excellent. And I didn't put this in the original questions I sent you, but do you have any comment on the situation with Iran and Israel possibly flaring up or even going to war over that and what that would do to oil prices?
Sure. So I think it's very easy to make the case that if there's any conflagration with Iran, so what I mean is if there's any kind of an attack or Iran starts to expect an attack, then they will make moves to block the Straits of Hormuz, which are very, very critical for seabound oil exports from the Persian Gulf, and oil prices will spike. I would not expect that to be long-lasting. The Iranian Navy is not very good. The Iranian Army is not very competent. They have a lot of missiles, and we've seen when they send those missiles towards Israel, most of them can be intercepted. The proxies, Iranian proxies, Hamas, Houthis, Hezbollah, there's sort of three H's, they're really on the back foot right now. Their resources have been degraded. The Iranian economy is very, very weak. And so that's one sort of piece to the puzzle of answering your question. You could have a real spike in oil prices because Iran will have to do something if they feel like if their oil facilities are bombed or something like that. But that's unlikely to have a lasting effect on oil prices because of the supply-demand balance and also because the staying power of that Iranian response is quite low. Now, that's one piece. I'll mention a second piece, Jerry, because I know you're interested. This wasn't an original question, so probably piqued your interest. There is a complex game being played by four players right now, and it's always hard to tell what all four are thinking. This is Iran, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the U.S. So the U.S. has made some very clear shifts in their policy in the last week. And it's very, very different than the Israeli policy towards Iran. So what the U.S. would like to have, and the Trump administration is, they would like to have some kind of peace, some kind of stable peace where they can do business, like in Trump 1.0. Trump 1.0, they were trying to get the Saudis together with Israel and have some kind of accord. This is how the Abraham Accords were started, so you can have more stability in the region, more prosperity, and the U.S. would get benefit from that and get credit. And part of that is to have stability from Iran, which is the most destabilizing influence on the rest of the region. So there's potential for the U.S. to really give some concessions in return for some kind of meaningful promise, a hard promise. However that could be enforced is difficult for Iran not to be a destabilizing player, let's say, for the next 3, 4, 5 years. That's a very difficult thing to do, and that's why it has never happened in the past. So it could be, this negotiation is very complicated. These four players don't like to show their cards, especially the Iranians. So I guess the biggest thing, if you're going to remember one thing about this, it's that Iran is very weak right now. Their proxies are weak. Their economy is weak. They don't have a lot of strong allies. Russia has really been, have to pay attention more to this war with Ukraine. So I wouldn't expect any problems that cause a spike in oil prices to be long-lasting.
That would make sense, and I agree 100% with that. All right, let's jump one more time. I know I really appreciate your time. It's been excellent, one of our better interviews we've done in a long time. I want to jump to the Trump administration. I've gotten this comment from a number of people, geopolitical-type experts. They said Trump's cabinet appointees in his first regime were different. Now, this group of appointees, from what I can see, and I'm on the outside looking in, seem to really be totally committed to the mission from Elon Musk and all the other lieutenants down. Now, his first administration, I don't think, was that way. I think many of his lieutenants, if you want to call them that, probably supported Trump publicly, but secretly sort of kept their distance because what they thought might happen to them later on when they would have to go back to the private sector. You have any comments on this?
Sure. It's a great question. I think the answer is a little more complicated than that sort of consensus view out there. What you can say for sure, and this has been highly problematic the last 3 months, is that Trump 1.0, the big players, Gary Cohen or a few of them, they had no problems whatsoever telling President Trump if they thought he was wrong, if they thought he was way off. Mm-hmm. And so there's lots of these sort of great stories on the internet about this interaction. I don't think that President Trump took it personally. His approach, at least in Trump 1.0, was there's different factions in my administration. I like chaos. Let's have them fight it out and see who wins. And it, you know, it had some success. It had some failures, but it often worked. Totally different this time. What you have is a number of, first of all, Trump loyalists. So they have to be loyal to the president to get their foot in the door, but also to the extent that they disagree with the president, they probably do not bring it up, certainly not externally, and not internally. So I'll give you the best example, because this is someone who I think is widely respected on Wall Street. This is Scott Bessent. Mm-hmm. So I met him in the early 2000s several times when he was heading up the European operations for the Soros Fund Management Group. He's just extremely successful, very bright, and a real gentleman. And that's the problem, Jerry. If he disagrees with the president, he won't say it publicly and probably will not argue with the president either. Mm. He's from South Carolina, so I don't want to get into stereotypes or anything, but he's not really a brash person. So I think it's really telling that he was very unsettled by what happened with the bond market. Mm-hmm. Selling
off
as the stock market and the dollar. And so he then felt, look, I really have to do something here. And he went to Mar-a-Lago. We don't know what he said, but what he probably said was, this is costing you all of your political capital on something that's a very small part of your overall agenda, tariffs, you know, tax cuts, deregulation. This is so much less controversial. You know, just let it go, or let it go as much as you can. I think that's my window onto the administration. I'm very, very nervous that a number of people that are in this administration have very little relevant experience in the area over which they're in charge. Hmm. Definitely not the case for Scott Bessent. He's
right.
a perfect position as Treasury Secretary, but there are others that they really don't have a lot of experience in that area. And I think that's what happened on April 2nd. Calculations were done by people that don't have the expertise, and they made mistakes
in the calculations. That makes total sense.
I worry that might happen on a much more important geopolitical front. Hopefully not, Jerry.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Great information, David. Thank you for being on the show. I got one final question, which I did not send you in advance, but it popped into my mind today. I thought, I need to ask you this one. I just watched a Zoom call by one of your competitors, if you want to call it that, which you probably could guess because I think you used to work for them. But anyway, they
just
did
for 28 years.
Yeah. Well, they did a webcast on the United States. Of course, this was a very, very long-term, 10, 20, 30-year kind of approach they were taking to it, on the United States and world exceptionalism. Is America losing that? Are we at threat of losing that? Is it too early to tell? Do you have any comments on that?
Sure. So I think, that's the great thing about these very long-term arguments, that mm-hmm. even 5 years is a very long period of time when the pace of change geopolitically, U.S. domestic politics, and on the technology front in the U.S., it's very, very rapid in all three areas. And so when the whole trick to this sort of long-term forecasting, 5 years out, 10 years out, especially for investors, is you have to take the elements of today and do a reasonable extrapolation mm-hmm. in the knowledge that you will probably be wrong, that there's probably something will occur in the next month or year or 3 years that will force you to adjust. This is Bayesian theory for statisticians out there. Right. You just keep adjusting. And so in the case of the U.S., take today. There's four things that you want to take into account. The first thing, and I heard this traveling across Europe last week, the first thing is, for the past 2 years, foreigners have been loading up with U.S. Financial assets, mm-hmm. stocks and bonds, unhedged. They are just loaded up. They bought $1.2 trillion last year of U.S. assets. And so that embodied the assumption of U.S. exceptionalism. So the first thing is, if you're talking about foreign investors right now, they are extremely unhappy and they feel they made this really big bet and how do I get out of it? Because I'm nervous about the downside. They're starting to extrapolate to the downside right now, which usually tells you that people have gone too far. They got overloaded with U.S. Mm-hmm. Now they have a massive buyer's remorse. Maybe it's going to go too far to the other side. And maybe we hit that when stocks, bonds, and the dollar all sold off together, which is extremely rare in the U.S. It happens in emerging markets all the time, number one. Number two, geopolitically, the U.S. exceptionalism is associated with the U.S. as the world's policeman, the hegemon. Hmm. And it's very clear, not just from President Trump, but from previous presidents, that it's impossible for the U.S. to finance this. Now, what usually happens in the decline of empires, as you know, this is Paul Kennedy's book, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, is they don't pay attention to that, and they think they can pay for it. And then they just, they blow it. They, you know, they just run out of money trying to stay the world's policeman. I think the good side of what President Trump is trying to do is he's saying we can't do it, we won't do it, we have to get others to pay for it, but we're also going to pull back, even if they pay for it. So the second thing about U.S. exceptionalism is, will they be realistic, or will they try and blow out the budget like the Romans did, and you know, there's this whole history of it. That's the second thing. The third thing is, U.S. exceptionalism, the last 2 years for investors has been tied to the Magnificent Seven tech stocks and the idea that U.S. tech will be a world beater. And I have to say that the capital spending budgets of just four of those companies are planned to be $450 billion this year. Just four companies, Meta, Amazon, like it doesn't matter. They're making a huge bet right now that AI will require massive capital spending, and at the end of the day, it will give them strong monopoly power, or a moat, M-O-A-T, moat, is what they call it in the technology sector, and they'll get a good return on capital. Not tomorrow, not next month, but longer term. If that works out, then I can probably bet that U.S. exceptionalism is intact. If that turns out to be the worst bet of all time, and China can do it for one-tenth the price with the deep seeks of the world, then U.S. exceptionalism is probably in trouble. That's number three of U.S. exceptionalism. Number four is Washington itself and fiscal policy and the dysfunctionalism we've seen for a long, 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 long time in anything that they attempt to do in Congress. It just becomes purely partisan politics. And so the end of U.S. exceptionalism is, will that result in some kind of fiscal crisis where you have the interest rate getting so high relative to the ability of the economy to grow that you have a fiscal crisis? This is called like the fiscal mass, fiscal debt arithmetic. So I'm not at all convinced that will happen, but if they start to become irresponsible, Scott Bessent, for example, resigns because he really wants to keep the budget deficit under control no matter what. He resigns or he's fired. I start to worry again about U.S. exceptionalism. So those are the four factors that I'll be watching as time goes by.
That is outstanding. One of the better interviews we've done in a long time. Dave, I love having you on our show. We'll have to invite you back maybe in 6 months or so, or if something radical changes, if you're available. So thank you. And I'll,
sure, Jerry,
again, I'll
thanks
tell
so
everybody
much for
about
your kind
audience.
Words. If they're even half true, I'll take it.
All right. Thank you, David. Appreciate it.
Jerry Tuma Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, We are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.